Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September the 2nd, 1999, and in Creekside Room this afternoon is Leroy Eisenminger session called Victim Offenders Reconciliation Programs, number 99-9. Let's listen in.
Before I forget it, if you're planning to attend my lecture tomorrow, I'm going to be kind of summing up. For 2 weeks now, I've been talking about prison ministry and related ministries, why we need to be involved with these people who are listed in Matthew 25 as the least of these, my brethren, Jesus calls them. But if you're going to be here tomorrow, the prelude to tomorrow is reading this sermon. Because tomorrow I'm going to kind of do some summation, some thoughts. This particular sermon was preached by Richard Hansen of Luther College 12 years ago on the first day of college in the fall. And I'd like to have you be familiar with what he's saying in here, and we're going to be talking about that tomorrow. So, Arthur, if you take one of those and pass them on. What we are doing here, folks, today is to... Yesterday we considered the differences between what we presently call retributive justice. Retributive justice versus restorative justice. And we ask different questions in retributive justice. Who did it? Okay? What? Now I think here. What does the offender deserve? And here we are talking about punishment. Crime is a broken law of the state. Okay. And when the offender has served so many years in the penitentiary, we say then he has paid his debt to society. In restorative justice, we ask different questions. What happens to the relationship? How can we bring about healing? And we're going to be watching a demonstration of that. I have some sheets here that show the difference between the two, between retributive justice. Yeah, you got those already. Okay. And then here is a summary of what we call changing lenses, looking at crime through different lenses. And I'd like to have you read with me the first paragraph. According to Howard Zaher, read that with me. According to Howard Zaher, the assumptions which govern our response to wrongdoing are in fact out of step with the experience of crime, with our Christian roots, and even with much of our own history in the West. What is needed, Zaher contends, is a new lens to help us see beyond alternative punishments and even beyond alternatives to punishment. We now need to look for alternative ways of viewing and understanding both the problem and solution, What if we used restorative lenses rather than retributive lessons? And so we're going to start this period with a video that was produced by the Evangelical Lutheran Church this last year. It's part of what's called Mosaic. Each congregation within the ELCA received a copy of this. And what you are going to be seeing took place in South Dakota within our prison system. The program that we're talking about today is a program that was started by the Mennonites, but it's a program called VORP. Victims, offenders, reconciliation program. You see, this program understands that something happened to relationships within the community, and how can we bring about healing of those broken relationships. And so the lady who is what we call the mediator in the process of victims, offenders, bringing victims and offenders together and bringing healing is a lady that shares the same office building with us. She's just down the hall from me, and this is an experience that happened at our penitentiary that she was involved in.
How do you see the church? What about the world? 4 times a year, Mosaic brings the field into focus. Mosaic, the video magazine of the ELCA. Seeing is believing.
This is a production of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
I believe that it was God's will that Mark should die on February 27, 1994. He died because of what I did.
There's no birds, no plants. It was silence. And every once in a while, you'd find an infant grave with a little cross on top of it.
Just as I club made you recover until they get off the bus. There's a whole other reality.
I'm John Byron.
And I'm Lydetta Bull. Thanks for watching.
In this issue, we'll look at a new approach to crime and punishment.
We'll also learn how Lutherans are pitching in to help the victims of Hurricane Mitch.
Our final story targets a creative program for reaching at-risk youth. On the morning of Sunday, February 27, 1995, one life ended. Two families were devastated. And the tiny South Dakota farming community changed forever.
We lived in a trailer house in Wichita, South Dakota, and some of my friends and I went out and we were partying that Saturday, the 26th. Later on that evening, we came back to the trailer house and I had a lot of money. While I was handling it, I allowed it to the point that Mark caused it to go out. The next thing I remember was hearing a fire, looking up and seeing my friend with a tiny red spot on the front of his chest.
Rather than call authorities, Travis Hensham fled. A month later, he was captured in Texas and returned to South Dakota. There, he pled guilty to first-degree murder and began a 45-year sentence in the South Dakota State Penitentiary.
tough thing on a Sunday morning to have the sheriff come to your house and say that your son is dead.
There he is.
Ted and Pat Nelson are members of Trinity Lutheran Church. Ted farms the land, Pat has a beauty shop.
I had to have a closure. I had to want him to look at me right in the eye and say, Pat, I am so sorry for killing your son or for taking your son's life. I needed to hear that before I could forgive him.
For Travis and the Nelsons, what appeared to be an ending has turned into a beginning through a new program in South Dakota known as Victim Offender Reconciliation. Lois Trent is director of the program. Eastside Lutheran Church in Sioux Falls provides Lois with office space.
The mission of the Victim Offender Reconciliation Program is to bring together victims and offenders to talk about the facts, the feelings, and the consequences of crime.
While serving his sentence, Travis attended a class offered by Lois. There, he saw a way to begin the healing process.
I wanted to face him. I wanted to talk to him. It was something I felt I had to do.
About 2 years ago, on my birthday, January 23rd, I got this letter from Travis. And it had this victim offender reconciliation pamphlet in it.
After meeting with both parties separately, Lois arranged a face-to-face meeting between Travis and the Nelsons.
I wanted to do this. I wanted to hear what Travis had to say, because we never had the opportunity to visit with him, to know exactly what had happened in his mind.
The Nelson mediation was my first mediation doing with a crime of severe violence, and so I was really cautious.
It was a very frightening experience at first, but we talked, I heard them tell how they were affected.
You're physically drained because you're going through everything, his side, our side, what we were doing, what he was doing during those 30 days that he was gone. And we were just praying when I got out of there, but it was like 500 pounds were just thrown right off my shoulders.
It may not seem very big, you know, but to me it was something big, because it was a step towards doing something I felt I needed to do. I have the relief of knowing that at least made a step towards doing that, you know, that, you know, everything isn't okay, you know, it isn't okay for them, it isn't okay for me, but I know that we can, you know, we made a step and we can go on from here.
Victim offender mediation is part of a nationwide trend known as restorative justice. Unlike traditional or retributive justice, restorative justice focuses on the victim and the offender. This new approach also looks at the community as well as the state. Although the process may not change an offender's sentence, restorative justice seeks to bring reconciliation and healing. Dora Larson heads the Illinois Department of Corrections Victim Services Program.
Everyone thinks victims want revenge. Victims really don't want revenge, they want to be made whole. And they want to have some kind of voice. And the thing is, a victim loses so much power if the crime is committed against them. They can have some power in the decisions being made, and somebody listen.
Making people whole is the key to restorative justice. Jane Oddy helps prisoners give back to society through a Habitat for Humanity project in the Illinois prison system.
Restorative justice is about addressing the harm that is created by crime, and restorative justice is about the people affected by crime. I am so excited about a restorative justice program that we have within our ministry, and that is called Building Homes, Rebuilding Lives. Habitat affiliates contact me and our colleagues, and we make a plan for a home to be built for a low-income family. And so prisoners then build the home, and what they do is interior, exterior walls, and often the trusses of that home. And they do it within the prison setting. That kind of relationship is the beginning of a future, not just for the prisoners, but for the Habitat families and everybody that we bring into the prison.
For Travis Hingem and the Nelsons, restorative justice and mediation have helped to bring healing.
the year that Mark died, it was our 25th wedding anniversary year. And Mark and Steve had wanted us to have an open house, a celebration. After Mark died, we thought, oh, we don't want to mess with it, you know, we're just going to cope with the grief, and that would be enough for that year. But the more we thought about it, the more we thought, we're going to do it for Mark. And I gave Ted the job of cleaning up the basement, Mark's room. He's putting stuff up in Mark's closet, and he found this grocery sack. And he come upstairs, and it was just white as a ghost. And I said, what's wrong? And he opens the sack, and here is this beveled glass frame. It didn't have a picture in it, and it has 25 and roses etched on it. And we found it that day that we celebrated our 25th anniversary. And we held each other, and we could just feel God and Mark's arms right around us, knowing that this is what he wanted us to do, and the Lord wanted us to do it too.
So I believe that it was God's will that Mark, you know, should die on February 27, 1994. He died because of what I did. He died because of my actions. He died because I was, you know, had no business messing around with that rifle.
If we wouldn't have God on our side, it wouldn't be the same.
Well, I don't think we could forgive.
No.
I don't think we could forgive the offender if we didn't have faith. Because our human nature says, we took our son, an eye for an eye. But Christ gave his life for us. Psalm 126, verse 5 says, those who sow in tears will reap with songs of joy. And with that, we have joy with our tears.
At the end of the hour, we'll also see another one. This is called Victims, Offenders, Reconciliation Program. And it was started by a group of Mennonites in Elmira, Ontario, Canada. And when it first began, it began outside the judicial system. Now, Lois, the lady that you saw here, who works in our office close there, receives referrals from courts. And one of the last referrals that she received was from a judge in Minnehaha County, where we are. Two teenage boys had broken into a lumberyard and had caused a lot of lumber to fall unstacked and got all mixed up and everything. And the kind of program that they worked out was that these boys, instead of going to a juvenile detention center, would restack the lumber and then also do community service. And the questions is not to ask the question, what should be done to the offender, but how can we bring about healing? What can we do to make things right? Read a portion here of a If crime is injury, what is justice? Again, a biblical understanding points the way. If crime harms people, justice should be a search to make things right between people. When a wrong occurs, the central question ought not to be what should be done to the offender, or what does the offender deserve? Instead, the primary question ought to be, what can we do to make things right? Instead of defining justice as retribution, we will define justice as restoration. If crime is injury, Justice will repair injuries and promote healing. Acts of restoration, not for their harm, will counterbalance the harm of the crime. Now, how did you see that demonstrated in the video that we call the mosaic? How did you see that demonstrated? Was there closure? Was there healing that came as a result of that? And what would have happened had this program not been available for the Nelsons, do you suppose? What did she
say? It would have taken longer. Yeah. They might have come to it, but this really helped.
Yeah. And when she met the young man who killed her son and got to talking about it, what did she say happened to her? The weight just lifted off. And one clear advantage of the mediation process is its potential for assisting victims of crime. Now, our present system focuses on the offender and on securing a conviction. One observed, the prosecutors may be interested in convictions and death penalties, while the victim's main concern is that she wants to get her purse back. Mm-hmm. And in the mediation process, the victim's needs are central. In retributive justice, the needs of the state, the broken rules of the state are central. In restorative justice is what happened to the victim. What did the victim experience? And many victims of crime speak of the need to talk about what has happened to them and to give voice to their pain, their fear, and their anger. Now, many times this does not happen in our present judicial system.
Can I tell about Mac? Mac is up there. He was telling me that our prison used to have a program where they would bring inmates into a community so that they could tell about the crime and this sort of thing, hope you do, to keep kids away from it. One of this Mac was saying that he had gone into a community and told he was there because of rape. And he said afterwards, a young girl came up to him and she just went all to pieces and told him that she'd been a victim of rape. He said, seeing her, how what it had done to her, and talking to her, he said, that did more to me, to let me know how my crime had affected someone than anything else. And, you know, he thought that was really something that he should have been able to face, and this girl was the one who made it face. It wasn't anything to do with the board or anything, it was just how he realized then what he had actually done to this other person, and he saw the pain that this girl had
gone. And, Marf, you bring up a subject. Rape victims often are made to feel, even by their family members, by the courts, you are somehow responsible. You brought this on yourself. And they don't have an opportunity to voice their feelings and their pain, and they need to bear witness to the injustices they have suffered and the ways in which they've been violated. And there needs to be that kind of opportunity for friends and families and other people to listen and to share in the grief. But some victims are also helped by being able to express their pain and anger to the people who have wronged them. And this is what makes what we call in this program mediation. Now, yesterday I used an example that happened in our state, and Dick, I think you were here, but bear with me again. Out in Presho, South Dakota, there were two teenage boys who were children of migrant workers. That was a strike against them already. And they broke into the Lutheran church there and did $50,000 worth of vandalism. And the community and the church were about ready to string them up. I mean, the anger level was extremely high. I was to preach out there The Sunday after it happened, they had part of the fellowship hall cordoned off. There was plywood in the place of the stained glass windows that they had broken out, and these people were just extremely angry. And I knew the president of the congregation. He's a personal friend of mine, and we suggested this process. They were quite skeptical at first, but Lois, the lady that here, went out there, made arrangements to meet with the church council, made arrangements to meet with the boys and their families, and they went through this process of where the families had a chance to express how they felt, the hurt this was done to our church, and they got it out into the open, and the boys had a chance to express how they felt. They drew up a covenant of where the boys promised to work off the insurance deductible. And what they did then was to scoop snow for elderly ladies, shut-ins, meals on wheels. They brought meals to them. They mowed their lawns, got heavily involved in helping older people. One of the boys and his family moved away before it was completed, but the other boy remained on, and sort of the community, the church, sort of took him under their wing. He even went up to church on days when the ladies' aid, or ELCW, I guess you call them then, were making quilts, and he would help cut out blocks for these quilts. And at Christmas time, he came over to church and helped decorate the church. And on the evening of the Sunday school program, they called him, the president of the WELCA, called him to the front of the congregation. He stood there in front of everybody. And here came two other officers of the WELCA with one of the quilts that the ladies had made, and they together wrapped that quilt around him.
Oh.
And the congregation stood and just applauded. Now, think of the difference of what would have happened had not this young man could have very easily been thrown into the judicial system, gone to Plankington, which is our reform school, we use that word so strangely, and you know, probably the ripple effect of what would have happened to the rest of his life. This is, to me, it was one of the beautiful, and so when the people of Mosaic called, they asked me if there was an example, and I said, well, there's that, and they thought, well, we're going to come right out to South Dakota and do that. Well, instead, they did this other one, but the restitution might be financial. Yeah, these boys paid off that deductible, but some mediation sessions have resulted in agreements that offenders will provide restitution in the form of services or work for the victim. And especially important for some poor people who have been victimized. I mean, if a man is very dependent upon his car to get to work, and that car has been stolen and wrecked, and he doesn't have money or insurance to buy a new one, it's very important that some type of restitution is vital. But it can also be a symbolic function. It symbolizes that someone has been wrong, okay? Here, crime is a law, broken law against the state, and retributive justice, as we're doing it now, restorative justice says a person has been harmed. And Jesus in Luke 6 says this, "And of him who takes away your goods, do not ask them back again. And as you wish that men would do to you, do so to them." And what I read into that is that Jesus is saying is that the most meaningful restoration is not property, but right relationships. How can we restore community? And for offenders, mediation offers the possibility of constructively working through the guilt that their action has been brought about. Our judicial system maintains, like I mentioned before, that the offender owes a debt to society. But tell me, what does that mean? kind of a strange term. But that's a vague term. And in mediation, the offender meets the real person who has been harmed. And mediation focuses on the actions that have hurt and the actions that might heal, and thus we avoid labeling and stigmatizing the offender as an evil person. And I have shared in my classes before here that often when I go to congregations and talk about prison ministry, I will ask children in a children's sermon, what is a prison? And the answer I get most often is prison is a place where bad people go. And that gives me an opportunity to correct these children, and hopefully their parents are overhearing the children's sermon. Prison is a place where good people who have made terrible choices, wrongful choices, irresponsible choices, violent choices, prison is a place where people have made those kinds of choices go. And the mediator who comes to work out the relationship between the two does not impose their interpretation on it. They don't say this guy is guilty or he's innocent, nor do they propose a solution. How are we going to bring about healing here? Participants, both the offender and the victim, come together to bring about their own outcome of their relationships. And both parties tell their stories. Both parties get a chance to ask questions. Both parties get to ask what happened. In the case of the Nelsons, the victims never got to hear exactly what went on in the trailer house that night of their son's death. They didn't hear about what was happening there in the trailer house. They just knew that this man that was standing in court that day was being accused of their son's murder. And they knew nothing about the actual events that led up to what happened. And they get a chance to tell about the impact of the crime that had on them. We might think, well, these guys who commit crimes, they're pretty calloused. Some are pathological. Some apparently don't have a conscience. But I have lost track of the number of times I've gone down the cell halls, and I'll be talking to the guys, and I'll ask them, is there something I can do for you? And generally speaking, the answer I get goes something like this: yes, there is, Pastor, you can do something for me, but I know you can't do it. Give me just 2 minutes of my life to live over. Mm-hmm. And one man said, just give me 10 seconds to live over. And what a difference it would make. But VORP, this organization that comes in and does this, allows these men to express their remorse and allows them the opportunity, face to face, to ask this victim, will you forgive me? And it helps the victims understand some of the situation. I'm thinking of the first president of the congregation that we started inside the penitentiary. A fine young man. I mean, I would trust, his name happens to be Leroy too, I would trust him to babysit our grandchildren. I mean, this guy, but what happened was, one night he had heard rumblings in Pier that his wife was fooling around with somebody else. And He went out looking for her one night when she wasn't home, and there's a bar in Fort Pier that's notorious for kind of its rough environment, and he went there, and sure enough, there was his wife with this guy. And when the guy saw Leroy come in the door, he reached over and picked up the wife and set her on his lap and said, "Leroy, you're not much of a man if you can't keep your woman at home." And Leroy, in addition to being extremely hurt and angry, went out and got drunk. And the next thing he remembers is in the morning, somebody pounding on his door. And he reaches down to put on his shoes, and he notices there's blood on the shoes. And the sheriff, who happened to be a personal friend of his, said, "Leroy, you're going to have to come with me." He had shot and killed his wife and her lover. And he has absolutely no memory of it.
Can I add something in there? I was talking to this man one night, and he said, "You know, there are times when before I open up my eyes in the morning in my cell, I think, now when I open my eyes, is it all going to have been a bad dream and I'm home in my own bed?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's a good man.
Yeah.
And if I didn't believe that these people in prison are redeemable and reclaimable, I couldn't work there. Mm-hmm. And this is why I've never been selected for a jury that involves the death penalty.
Yeah.
Because those people who advocate the death penalty seem to say these guys are lost, there's no hope for them, let's get rid of them on their society. Okay, I'm going to show you the next video, which shows this thing, this process from beginning to end.
Could I ask about the church vandalism? Did the restitution replace the judicial?
Yes.
In that case, it did, huh?
Yeah, the judicial people weren't involved. The boys were referred to them by the juvenile court.
So sometimes this approach does replace
what would
be the normal.
Yeah, like the boys that had done the work in the lumber yard, that was a referral to VORP.
In the United States. And even minor ones, the victim responded by questions. Why me? Why did you do it? Even if the offender is caught and convicted, the questions are seldom answered in the direct terms the victim wants to hear, but that's changing. As offenders and victims are brought face to face to talk it out and to make amends, we begin our story in Elkhart, Indiana. Johnny Strickland thanked the Lord for her many blessings. She's a good driver, but now she's afraid to drive after dark because of what happened at this rural Indiana intersection before dawn one October morning.
This is not the same darkness that it was. It's a really scary feeling right now. I was going to work that morning, and the next minute when I woke up, I saw blood on my head and on my arm, and the windshield cracked. I thought, was it my fault? Did I hurt them really bad? Did I kill them at all?
In fact, the other driver was at fault. She had run a stop sign. Miraculously, both drivers were sent home with only minor injuries. Even so, it was the worst thing that had ever happened to Johnny Strickland. 30-year-old Kelly Robinson was no stranger to trouble. She was driving drunk, and it wasn't the first time.
I took the car keys, and I went and got a bottle of wine, and I came back home and drank it, and then I left again. I didn't think I would get caught.
In fact, Kelly had been caught three times before. This was her fourth drunk driving charge. She had no license and no insurance. But Kelly was not sent to jail. Instead, Judge Olgus Stickle suspended a four-month jail term and a $1,500 fine. That suspended sentence came with a string attached, that Kelly agreed to participate in a program called VORP, Victim-Offender Reconciliation Program. She would have to meet Johnny again, not in court, but face-to-face with a mediator.
Today you'll tell me, basically, your side of the story.
Colleen Dick will be Johnny and Kelly's mediator. She briefs them each separately before they meet for the first time since their day in court. MORP is the rare criminal justice program that exists to help the victim of crime.
Do you think that the pain you suffered after the accident had less to do with the accident than that anger you were carrying around inside you?
I thought you put somebody right in jail and give them a big fine, and she didn't have any of that. That's when I started hating her and had all the bad feelings toward her, like I really wanted to put her away for good.
Ever since the accident, Kelly has been different, too. She's been sober for 9 months, living in a halfway house for recovering alcoholics. She goes home to her husband and 2 small children one day a week.
You know, most people do scrapbooks and collages and things like proms and parties and best friends and stuff. This is hardly that.
What I wanted on here is more drinking got me.
What do the 4 cars represent?
Cars of wrecked and drinking accidents.
You've wrecked 4 cars?
Not total. This is the one that was actually totaled.
Death wish? Do you think you have a death wish?
I think for a while I was wondering if I did. Inside, I'd be screaming for help or wanting something, anything to change within me. But it wasn't there yet.
The day for the mediation finally arrives. Kelly goes first.
My way to escape was through the bowel and in the car. I blacked out and I don't even remember hitting you. But mostly I remember the desperateness inside of myself that I felt. I remember oftentimes I would think of my kids growing up without a mother, or me being gone for a year or two or however long, and people saying their mommy's in jail. After this accident, when I went to treatment, they were talking about I should go to a halfway house, and I couldn't bear leaving my children. My son had just turned 2. All he knew was that his mommy left him. He stood at the basement door for days, I guess, thinking I went down there to do the laundry and never came back up and stand there crying for me. And I would hear about these things from other people and it tore my heart out. And I'm going to tell you that there has not been one single day go by in my life these last 9 months when I haven't thought of you. And I wanted to call you many times. But I didn't have the guts. I didn't have the guts. And I didn't know how to apologize to somebody that I almost took their life away.
Johnny had waited 9 months to tell Kelly what she'd been through.
It doesn't seem fair being a victim. It didn't seem fair that day in court. It didn't seem fair that morning. I was very frustrated at the police officer, very angry, because he didn't put you away that day. And all I kept thinking was, boy, she's going to go out and do it again. What's the difference of having these laws? I didn't get no apology, no nothing from you that day. And I felt, if I do ever see her, she'll find out what sorry means. I just had this guilt and this hatred towards you. And I don't want to hate you for the rest of my life.
Pay restitution to Johnny. They'll negotiate the amount. Lost wages, medical bills, what car insurance didn't pay. Restitution isn't always made in dollars.
Hey, watch your hand when this stuff is sharp.
14-year-old Ronnie is working off the damage he and three other kids did last May to Greg Gomes' house in Hayward, California.
It looked like the cyclone had gone through the house. Stereo was gone, all the speakers were gone.
Gomes had been robbed before and fully expected to be excluded from the justice system. But this time he was surprised. This time he got the chance to sit down with all four kids in mediations. The court will take the results into consideration later at sentencing.
It's a good deal that you can go in and say what's on your mind and what, you know, and tell them how you feel. It may not change anything for them, but it makes you feel better, you know. Because they leave it open to the
This time, mediation was one for four. Only Ronnie has stuck to his restitution agreement, working 16 hours at Greg's house and 352 hours of community service at a local boys' club.
I figured that he wouldn't like me a bit, but he's taken me out to eat. He lets me drive his truck, and he lets me work here alone. He puts radios out here for me to listen to when he's not home.
Ronnie's attitude sounds nice too, but Greg is reserving judgment.
He's still got a court date, so this may all just be to look good for the courts and everything else. I'll show him that I'll trust him, and I'll help him. But until he goes to court, and then he's out of court, and he's 4 or 5 months down the road, then I can say that he did all right, you know, and if it was worth it.
Mediating a crime of burglary like this is one thing. But a crime of violence is another, and it's rarely done. It's hard to imagine a victim of rape ever wanting to see her rapist again.
He raped me 3 times while he was there. He was there for 1 hour. He raped me 3 times.
That was 7 years ago, when Brenda Wood was 18. Maurice Thomas was convicted and sentenced to 10 years. Brenda got married and had 3 children. But something was very wrong.
I stayed in the house and hid from people and hid from myself, from the fear that I felt and the complete stripping of all myself, pride and self-esteem, everything that I built for 18 years, she took within an hour.
Her marriage failed. She started a rape crisis center to help other women in her town, Beloit, Wisconsin. But after all that time, Thomas was still a haunting presence in her life.
I hated him. I did want to kill him, you know. I wanted him to hurt just as bad as he hurt me. I wanted him to know what it felt like to have your life put on the line and have to beg for your life, have somebody tell you you're going to die, you know you're going to die. You know, and then the next day, think and wish, why didn't he kill me? Because this isn't worth living for.
And then someone suggested she try mediation.
And I looked at this lady like she was nuts. I said, you mean that I would have to talk to him like he's a real person?
But when Thomas agreed to it, they met again.
She was pretty tough, but you know, I had to respect it because I did it.
I asked him why.
But you know, it's in my head. I'm gonna get this prop, I'm gonna stick to it. You know, regardless how I'm gonna get her, I'm gonna get her.
I asked him why he didn't just kill me. He said, I could never hurt you.
She was just standing.
Shouted at him and asked him, what did he think he did?
I thought I would never in my life feel so bad about doing something, you know what I'm saying?
I think a lot of it might have been when he did say he was sorry. He had tears in his eyes like he was crying and looked at me and said,
I'm sorry for what I did to you, you know, Miss Wood. And I hope you forgive me.
I do forgive him, I know I did. Before the mediation, I just wasn't a whole person. I felt like a part had been stolen, and a hand. I didn't know how to get it back. But after the mediation, I didn't get that part back. But I found a new part that I liked a lot better.
The same can't be said for Thomas, who was paroled and is currently doing time again for assaulting two other women. But nobody claims mediation rehabilitates the offender. That's not a goal. The goal is to help the victim heal. If it happens to help the offender too, so much the better.
Call me anytime, because I want to be your friend as much as you want to be mine, because I think today has relieved the pressure, the anxiety, the hatred, the big cloud that was hanging over my head. Maybe the beginning for you, maybe a new beginning for me.
I hope so.
I know it will be. Just keep believing.
Okay?
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Forgiveness is not part of the mediation process. The mediators don't even bring it up. But victims often do, feeling the need to close the books on a painful experience and move on. Already, Kelly has sent her first two restitution checks to Johnny.
What has been learned from this process? 97% of the victims who have used the VORP program have said that they would do it again and would recommend this program to their friends. A recent study in Minneapolis, the victims said that it was not only the restitution that I received, but it was very important for me to meet the offender. What that did for me, they said in one voice, it allayed our fears, it reduced my picture of the stereotype I had of inmates, and they also found as a result that it was the victim who often insisted that this man get help, or this person get help for their crime. And it also gave these victims a sense of empowerment, and they felt that they had the opportunity to help change the offender's behavior. Of the offenders, some of these were included, 91% of the offenders said, I would do it again. And it increased, like my wife said, the awareness of what the victim experienced. Overall, this program has reduced recidivism. I mentioned the other day our M2 program in South Dakota. Those who've had a friend to come and visit them, the recidivism rate is less than 0.5%. Mm-hmm. The overall recidivism rate for those who've used VORP is even less than that. And both victim and offender, when they were asked the question, what is justice? The answer was, justice is making things right, which incidentally is a biblical concept that we talked about yesterday. Well, I'll stop there, and time is just about up. But questions or comments?
If a victim would like to do this, they can obviously. But if the offender says, "No, I don't want to do that. Forget it," then you still don't have that closure.
Right. But we have found in South Dakota that it is most often the offender who initiates the process. Lois Preheim there in my office has a whole number of letters from offenders who's saying, I want to be involved in this. I want to make things right between me and my victim.
Are they able to set those up with many of the people that requested?
Yeah. So far we have been able to kind of keep up with the demand. What is the church's role? And incidentally, there are VORP chapters in most large urban centers. The VORP movement desperately needs the church. Pressures to be sidetracked from this vision are many. You can about imagine that the regular judicial system doesn't want anything to do with it. I mean, because society's saying, let's punish people. Let's punish people. And but the church can provide, this author says, the church can provide the kind of independent value base and the independent institutional base which is necessary to carry out this vision. Motivated by a biblical vision of justice as restoration, the church can help in a very important way. If VORP is to survive as a catalyst for changing our judicial system, the church must remain involved. And so I hope, folks, that if you have the opportunity, some young kids in your community have gotten into trouble, that you will suggest mediation, the VORP program, to keep these kids out of the judicial system where, in my judgment, they are more harmed than helped. I have a friend who teaches at Augustana College. His name is Larry Brentrell. He works, teaches children at risk. And he says, we have the technology now and the tools to adequately predict which first graders will end up in prison. And if that be true, then why can't we invest more in prevention than we do in locking a person up after they've committed a crime? And I often tell people in South Dakota that what it costs to keep a man in a cage in South Dakota, you could send him to Yale for a year.
Yeah, 40-something down.
Yeah. So, thank you very, very much for being here today. I appreciate you.